you should set unreachable goals and then fail getting there doing more than you would have if you just set an achievable goal. Because often you sort of like fill to the capacity of whatever you set for yourself.
Welcome to Life After Launch, the podcast that takes you inside the hearts and minds of founders navigating the startup world. I'm Megan Luttrell. I run Aussie Founders Club, a community for founders, operators, and investors, and Kairos Recruitment, a company supporting startups and scale-ups.
Hi, I'm Gio George, partner at Mayfly Ventures. We're a venture studio building industry-focused AI and software ventures.
This is Life After Launch from Aussie Founders Club. We cut through the startup noise with unscripted stories and tactical advice from the founders who have built before us. This show is about what happens after you launch, the business lessons, the life lessons, and everything in between. That's Life After Launch.
Today, we meet Darius Monsev, founder, builder, and the guy behind one of the most quietly influential design platforms of the early internet. Two Y Combinator stints, more than $40 million raised, and two exits. When we recorded this, he had just landed in Melbourne and was building a new startup called Pre.
Not long after we recorded, he made the decision to walk away from Pre. And as you'll hear, that's exactly the kind of decision he thinks more founders should be willing to make. And maybe he was thinking about that while we were actually going through the record.
Quick note before we get to Darius. Last episode, we mentioned that we're always iterating. This week, that means a new closing segment, three life lessons. Three insights our guests wish they'd known earlier in their journey. Darius's were learned the hard way, so stick around for them.
I met you through Aussie Founders Club, deep in the Slack. We've had you involved with one of our earlier events of 2026 at the First Move. And we know a little bit about you, but the audience in Australia probably doesn't, unless they've found you on Wiki, which I have. He's got his own Wikipedia.
That's cool.
But if we start right at the beginning, can you tell us about where you grew up? Because it was in Australia.
I was born and raised in Hawaii, which actually feels somewhat similar to Australia. Like there's a little bit of the bird sounds or the island culture. So it feels a little bit like home. I mean, I'm 2 months into Australia, so we're still fully settling, but it's a warm reception. Also with the people have been incredibly generous and welcoming. But my parents were entrepreneurs, so I think I didn't choose this path. I was born into it a bit. Probably strongest motivation is my dad was a pretty successful entrepreneur, and I'm the seventh kid. And so he was quite wealthy and successful. By the time it got to the seventh kid, there was sort of none left. And so it was this nice, like, man, I really want. I saw what it was. It seemed pretty achievable. He's a good person, but not particularly an unreachable level to, so I want that back. So I've had a chip on my shoulder sort of my whole life of like, I'm going to get that back. Trauma informed. Probably most entrepreneurs have some level of trauma. It's not the healthiest pursuit to do something that is irrational, stressful, harmful. So you kind of have something that pushes you into it. So that was part of it, but it's the mixture of my dad is like a business, a bit chauvinistic, a bit of a charismatic liar, big story guy. And my mom is just a giant dreamer. And most of her stuff has always been for the better of the world and systems. And we talked a bit about systems thinking. And so I have this balance between the two of this egotistical capitalistic drive balance with a like, yeah, but make the world better in the process. So that's sort of my genesis in how I got started.
Are you the seventh of seven?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Any of the other kids have that chip on their shoulder, or was it being the seventh that sort of drove that?
Yeah, I think probably I'm the baby of it. So there's four from my mom and dad, and then there was three before. So my dad's 98 years old. So some of my half siblings are like much older than me. But none of my siblings sort of ended up with the same entrepreneurial drive as me. They all like live good quality lives and creative pursuits, but yeah, maybe I got less of it and was more motivated to go and get it. There's a bit of the naughtiness in entrepreneurship. I have a summer camp for kids, and it was sort of the same skill set that makes an entrepreneur is sort of good for criminal activities as well. You know, it's like you have to believe the rules don't apply to you. You know better than everyone else. You see the way things should be done. Like you can see how that gets corrupted into some bad behavior. And so as a kid that got bad grades in school, not because I couldn't do the work. So that in the States, I got a 2.0 GPA, which made me ineligible for sports, which was sort of my life. And then I was mad at the school. So then I got a 4.3 GPA the next semester, which, because I played the system, it's the highest GPA you can get in the school. So like, I wasn't an idiot, but it was also like, why was I mad at the school for just giving me bad grades when I wasn't doing the work? So it was sort of clearly my fault. But that level of like, I'm going to bend the rules is a bit of the entrepreneurial foundation.
Actually, that's an interesting thing to dig into as well. Like, what it means to be an entrepreneur. Like, one way that you could look at entrepreneurship is just problem solving at different scales, right? I'm curious, what does entrepreneurship mean to you?
Well, I think there's a distinct difference between capitalist and entrepreneur. And I have, I think, not been solely motivated by money. There's a bit of like, maybe I wish I was a bit more motivated purely from a money perspective in my earlier years. But I think an entrepreneur wants to solve problems, or they have a vision of an idea in their head and they're compelled to get it out. It's I often, if a thought starts for an idea, I have to finish it. It's like a compulsion of like, this is going to bother me unless I get it out. And it doesn't have to be a full build. Now with AI, I can get further than I should into that. But it's about seeing something and then wanting to exist in the world. That to me is the entrepreneurship. And then, yes, you can make money from it.
I think also one thing, so when I grew up, I didn't want to break rules that made sense, but if they didn't, I would challenge it. And that actually was a curse to me working for people. I wish I had started my own thing earlier. So it's around like challenging the status quo essentially. And that's why entrepreneurs that do well because they do it some completely different to the people before. So you've grown up in Hawaii. We know, because we've done a bit of research, then you ended up in Portland. But how did you actually step into that sort of entrepreneurial career? And what was the first venture?
Hawaii is special. It's a wonderful place. But as a young, dumb, teenage male brain, I was like, I'm too big for this place. I got to get out of here. It was too slow. I had big, ambitious dreams. So I really didn't appreciate it growing up and just had to go, had to leave. Again, bad grades in school meant my college options or university for you options were not great. So I went to a bad school because that was where I put myself, and then dropped out to work for an internet company. And that taught me the skills to build in the early internet era, fairly old at this point. So like the beginning of this consumer web products was a very fun time. Flash was a new technology. People felt like they were sort of creative building, it was not just a MBA building a business, no offense if you have one. And so my first weird thing was I built a website for people to rate color squares. Like, do you think this color, it was a joke, is it hot or not for colors? This tan color, somebody hates and somebody loves. And so it's just a goof. I shared it with design friends. The thing that made it a useful tool was I then took a single color and let you arrange a 5-color palette. And the 5-color palette then was a resource for designers to use, because at the time there was no agentic tools or big resources. You have a client, I need to get a color palette. What goes well with this beige color? And the community was playing, being creative, but designers use it as a resource. So it grew to millions of visitors.
Did that exist? Because I've used those types of platforms now. Was that the first of its kind, or is that sort of like an original idea? Because now I feel like it's influenced. If it was, I've now used platforms that are influenced by that.
Yeah, there's a bit of a weird, I thought the other day of like, I'm old enough in this game to go, did I invent that? Like, it was, and then selective memories, you sort of make your own history. And the question was, did I make the love button? Because that is now synonymous on the internet. Because everything was like buttons. I did a love button, but Tumblr had done it like 2 months, 3 months before me. So I was not the one, but it's like, so I was the first to make, I think, a 5-color palette combination, which is funny because like Adobe uses that as a resource. Like, it's a main way to arrange a color palette. I didn't think that through. This is also the point of the internet. We don't think of the second order effects of the things that we build. And so now we're feeling now like, well, what if you just get insane news all the time in your face? What if AI takes everybody's jobs? That nobody thinks about those things. We're just random people who build a thing that then millions of people use. And so in my case, I built this design resource. That site is still up. It's 22 years old.
I think you can claim it though. If you don't know of any beforehand, it was still original thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a life after launch exclusive. There you go. Hot take.
Put it on my Wikipedia. Yeah. So,
can we just go to the Wikipedia page for a second? How does one get a Wikipedia page? Is that something that you start or
no? Because like the rules are, you're not supposed to make it for yourself, and I'm not supposed to edit it.
So supposed to edit it.
Well, I think a lot of people will pay other people to edit. I haven't edited. I mean, a lot of this stuff is wrong or missing things. Like, I could, I know my life.
Some of our research.
But I could go fill in gaps. I could change it, but I'm not supposed to. I just basically leave it. But yes, it has to be sourced by news articles. So you have to get coverage so that there's like third party places for that to quote from. So.
Okay. Maybe we start a Wikipedia page.
You can write each other's. You can't write your own, but you can write each other's. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So you have built this platform. It grew into a multi-million dollar community. So how did you build the community around that? It's because obviously you've got a platform where people are wanting to tell us the story of where that went.
Yeah, that was a overnight success that took 11 years. So I built this. I didn't mean to build this color website, but people kept using it. The Boxing Day tsunami had happened in Banda Aceh, Indonesia in like 2004. So I just went to volunteer, and then I had started this site, and then went and spent the next five months living in Thailand and setting this nonprofit up that does volunteer work. And when I had come back, the design community that I had shared it with wanted to get on, but couldn't. This is like a technical error. I set the ID for the user table to a small int, and then it broke. The site broke. It was like maybe the first private beta, unintentionally. Nobody could get in. And so it was this thing that was working. But I spent 2 years just doing the nonprofit and then working on this tech thing on the side. My co-founder of the nonprofit was a retired tech executive. And I'm doing this volunteer work. Again, this is my mom's maybe influence. Really impactful, helping people after natural disasters. Felt great. I'm getting paid like $20,000 a year. And my co-founder is like, got a comfortable life, retired tech executive. Like, he's getting the same value out of this as I am, of like the feel good in a very different way. So what if I went back to the entrepreneurship route? He was my angel investor. I'll come back to the rest of the story, but Color Lovers eventually was acquired and he got a great return for it. I took terrible times at the time, but went to a good person, owning some part of something's better than all or nothing. So it all worked out well. But the story with Color, how it got successful, was I had moved to San Francisco. I was wearing a Color Lover shirt. I'm sort of always wearing something branded.
We need to get shirts. Oh, you've got shirts.
I've got shirts.
Yeah, I need shirts.
There's a bit of like, I have ones that say Bub's Nose. Like, there's something that's like, I'm wearing somebody's brand. I might as well wear my own. But I went to a startup school event for Y Combinator. Paul Graham saw the shirt and said, oh, I love Color Lovers. Like, you should join YC. I was like, oh, that felt like I was too far at the time. And so that got me in to Y Combinator by wearing the shirt, my logo.
So it's unintentional to go. I mean, people like live their whole life being like, I just want to build a YC Combinator business. And you were just like,
just happened to run into Paul Graham.
Well, I went to their like startup school. My wife and I grew up together. She lived in San Francisco. We re-met at our 10-year high school reunion. I was at Microsoft in Seattle at the time. She was in San Francisco. And I was like, we're just going to go. We're going to move to San Francisco. We're going to give the relationship a go. And so I had just moved there right at the time where they're doing a startup school event. And yeah, I happened to wear my shirt, and it's a weird thing. The internet was maybe smaller at the time, so I was surprised he had even seen it. We were pretty, at the time, Dig was the major like source of internet traffic. Reddit now is, but Dig was sort of the king of internet traffic. It's now dead. But it meant if you got to the Dig homepage, it'd bring your servers down. Like, it was such an influx of traffic. And so I was pretty good at playing that game. I was a top digger. We had a bunch of exposure, so Paul Graham must have seen it.
Dig before?
In like the annals of internet history.
Yes. If when you go to the History Channel of internet, Dig's in there. But it was just the homepage of the internet. You upvoted stories. But because so many people saw it, it would be a massive amount of traffic. So
did Color Lovers get acquired by Microsoft? So how did you end up at Microsoft?
I was struggling. Color Lovers was like a terrible company for a long time. Like, we had millions of visitors. It was ad-based revenue. I hate ads. I don't want to put ads on my site. So I just suffered. And it was like, at one point, business account overdraft broke, personal account overdraft broke. The ad check I was waiting for didn't come in. I'm like, what am I going to do? I just got in my car and I was just going to like drive to nowhere in a depressed state. And then my car like check engine light came on. Like, I literally couldn't run from my problems. I just had to like sit in it and suffer. So it was that way for a long time. And then the Microsoft opportunity happened. Color Lovers had been a 5-time Webby nominee for best community. I don't know if the Webbies are still a thing.
No, they are.
They are very much a thing, yeah.
So Microsoft was trying to build a community in CNET. So Microsoft had approached me to join their Live Labs team. And I thought, oh, this is a paycheck. You know, I'm broke, so this would be great. The idea is I just go to work 8 hours a day for them, and then I'll have my nights and weekends. I was so worn out by being unfulfilled by the work that I did all day. There was nothing left. That seems crazy to do, but I'm just like this. I'm so frustrated all day. I could do 10 times this job. And then so it didn't really work, but I was there for a bit of time, high school reunion. And then I shipped it, went back to San Francisco. My wife was the breadwinner for the beginning of our relationship. Like I'm the broke entrepreneur living in her, you know, set the laptop up on the couch trying to build. So
there's nothing more. That's probably the best thing to do to test someone to see if they really love you is because like start an entrepreneurial journey and wait, have no money. Yeah.
Have no money all time, you know?
Yeah. Not be able to really give your all to everything, yeah. But yeah, cool. I love it.
Yeah. So what happened with Color Lovers though, is that we had gone through YC. It was weird to figure it out. Are we a color data company? But we had also built tools that made other kinds of design easy. So pattern designs and very easy ways to make seamless patterns. Two of those were acquired by big brands. They reached out to us and said, hey, we want to buy this pattern for an ad campaign. Like, it's not our pattern. We'll ask the creator. And then we just like brokered the transaction. We're like, oh, we should just do that. Like, that's the business. What if we built the best marketplace for creative assets? So an Australian success story is Envato. Collis did a great job building a federated marketplace. So Theme Forest for themes and Audio Jungle for audio. We grew up sort of at the same era. So ours was just, what if everything was in one marketplace? And so Creative Market is the overnight success. We launched that site 11 months later, acquired by Autodesk. It was a life-changing outcome.
Where was it acquired by?
Autodesk.
Yep.
Autodesk at the time was trying to do a consumer group and compete with Adobe. To their credit, they shut it down and then actually gave the site back to my co-founder. I had peaced out to Hawaii. We can talk about cows here in a second. But that was like this overnight success. But for 10 years before that, I'm like broke, struggling. But the lesson in that is like product market fit. It was getting closer to the transaction and realizing what is somebody willing to pay for? What solves a real need versus like, this is a fun thing. It's fun. But people wouldn't pay for the color data. They weren't going to buy like a membership for this color community. So it's just a bad business the whole way through. Creative Market was the marketplace that like made sense. I just bought fonts there. I have nothing to do with it now, but I still spend a decent amount of money on the marketplace. It's a successful place still.
So I feel like this ties into something you've already told me. When you did your first exit, like the exit's the thing everyone is trying to go build towards, but you found yourself in a position where you'd exited, but it wasn't enough to go sail off into the sunset. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, especially in San Francisco, the outcomes, like, you know, the grass is greener, the comparison to other people, they're insane comparisons. So my peers, guys I grew up in the tech world with in the early 2010s, multiples of them are billionaires. So my peers are incredibly wealthy. And I like made a few million dollars. Like, it's kind of a failure in comparison to them, to anyone else who's been like working their ass off for their whole life and has barely a bit of savings. Like, it's an incredible thing. And so this was just this dark, weird world of having exits that feel like failures in the comparison to people who are like exceptionally successful. So the first one, we made a few million dollars, which was like life-changing for me. But then you've got like earnouts, you've got taxes. It wasn't as much as I thought it would be. And then you sit down with the financial planner and like, cool, if you work till you're 50, you can retire. I was like, what? Like, that was the plan anyway. Of really, it made this foundation layer of like the, oh shit. Like, if things got really bad, we're okay. Like, you know, the mortgage is sort of paid off, but you still have to work. Like, that's not enough. And so anyone can work their own numbers out, but it's something like $10 million after taxes is where, if you park it super safe and you own your home, that throws off enough to comfortably sort of live forever. Granted, you can always live cheaper, but I got 3 kids. We like to travel a little bit.
And we're work that hard to just live off that. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's sort of a few hundred thousand a year is what you get if you park that, which is like, yeah, that's a very comfortable life, but it wasn't as much. So I was surprised. It was like, oh, that didn't do as much as I thought it would. Fortunately, I had a second exit, same sort of size, same outcome. The lesson there was I had sold my company. The guy I dropped out of college to work for had a web design company who I had worked for. I had showed him our success. And I think he's like, oh, I think I want that. It's like, well, you had built template websites for eye doctors. Inside of that was a weird or contact lens ordering system where faxes got sent. This is the beginning of direct to consumer. Pull that all out and just make a contact lens ordering thing where anybody can like do this. Direct to consumer, the contact lenses will get shipped. So I helped Travis like brand start, the genesis of that company. And then I didn't do much. He like ran it. But when he sold, I made as much money from that as the one that I bled on for 11 years. So it's sort of the argument for venture capital of like, pretty nice return for doing none of the work. So I get why that's an appealing model.
You wouldn't have had that opportunity, though, if you hadn't bled for 11 years to be the advisor, right?
I really don't ever. I've made for sure mistakes. I don't think I've harmed people along the way, but like I could have done things better. But then I would, you know, the butterfly effect of some change, would my life would be different. So I'm very happy with where things are.
You know, when I talk to entrepreneurs, especially like doing this podcast, there's this common thread of like, oh, I happen to be at this place and then this happened. And, you know, like there's a bit of serendipity that seems to play out. But I wonder if it's like opportunities that you're looking out for, or is there a way of looking at the world that makes those serendipitous moments a bit more obvious?
It's the book, The Secret, but it's Manifest Destiny. Like if you're looking for it, you'll see many more opportunities. If you believe everything sucks and you're not going to get anything, you're just not looking for it. The most obvious example is like you buy a car, you will see that same model of car everywhere. They were always there the whole time. You just were not paying attention to it, so you won't notice it.
You'll be surprised how many 2005 Toyota Corollas there are.
You would know. So I think there is a bit of a look. Yeah, it's luck and it's serendipity, but you make your own luck, if that makes sense. Like success in startups, you're going to have to be lucky. The same thing, I have those peers that are incredibly successful. I also have peers that have smarter than me, worked harder than me, and just haven't been successful. Like the luck didn't align with the time of what they were building to the right person. And so it's a pretty large component.
Where do we think we are now in the timeline, right? So you've gone and Color Lovers is going to Creative Market. You were part of Sitebox. We're about 2017 now?
Yep, 2017. We would have just moved back to Hawaii. So we exited. We thought we were going to like build our dream home on 40 acres. I don't know the hectare or square meters conversion for that, but it was like a lot of land, neighborhood sized. And an Instagram looks great. It's like the life everyone wants. And then I'm just depressed after a couple of years of that because one, I spent years at this high anxiety, high stress, full capacity. And then I didn't have that thing anymore, but then I just filled it with stuff, like not even stuff I needed to, just busy. And then I'm busy on the same level of like, well, I'm so busy today. I can't. And like, why am I busy? Like, what am I busy with? And it wasn't fulfilling. Like the thing about startups, the joke I always say is I've realized it's bad for my mental health. Not doing them is worse. There's just a trade-off I make of that. Yeah, it's incredibly stressful and hard, but it's the most fulfilling thing I can do. And so that I just keep doing them. And so Hawaii, I basically was at this full throttle with none of the fulfillment, sort of like chainsawing water or something. There's like no benefit to this high stress. And I think I missed the idea of building. Like I built it something that millions of people use. There was like the scale and impact of that. And then I enjoy hard work of any kind. And I did this whole fence, 1,000 meters of fence. It's like, yeah, but what is that? What did that do for the world? Like it just didn't matter. And so after that and the levels of privilege and comfort that we had was not really seeing depression. It's like, why do I feel like shit every day? It's like, oh, I'm depressed. I just wouldn't recognize it because I'm high functioning. I've got all these wonderful things in my life, you know, childhood sweetheart, my wife, we've got more kids, like life is pretty good. But it's like, I'm bad. Like I'm the rotten core in this barrel of fresh apples. And that led to, oh, I think I need to like build. That's my thing. I'm going to leave this dream life we build in Hawaii. I think we have to move back to the West Coast. Hawaii is very slow. I needed more stimulation. We moved back to Portland, Oregon, instead of back to the Bay Area, just so that there's a little bit more normal. San Francisco is so tech. Every conversation's tech. Every dinner, every friendship is tech, and not just high level tech. It'll be like, well, you know, Sonnet 4.6 is better than it's like, my wife doesn't care about any of that. And I don't want my kids growing up in that. So Portland is what we ended up moving back to so that I could sort of find purpose in building again.
There's something I've been grappling with as well, because there's so much of your build time where you're actually working these crazy hours because you have to survive, to make your business work, to get through the hump of like being one person with $0. And then when you start, what I'm finding is now I've actually got people around me that can help do that. When I'm sitting there on a Saturday afternoon, I can't just sit there because I'm like, I've known survival to be busy, and you would have been like having to be deprogrammed if you essentially wanted to go back to a normal life. And it seems that you were like, no, I'll just throw myself back into more of this.
I've seen some friends pull that off, and that seems really enjoyable. I'm just not wired that way. So like, I don't enjoy leisure time. We could sit in the backyard and I go, I gotta fix that. I gotta trim that thing. That's like, then I'm back to work. I spend 3 minutes sitting there like, I'm going to go get the saw out. I got to cut that thing. We're in a rental house. I'm still fixing things. It's not my house right now, but I don't enjoy the leisure. I like problem solving, which is why I'm stuck doing what I'm doing.
There's problem solving, and then there's also like kind of operating within the survival mode mechanism, right? I wonder if like that period of building a ranch and that downtime helped you reprogram a little bit, so you shifted more into creating from a place of abundance and, you know, creativity.
I think we talked earlier about The Secret and the idea that abundance is around you and opportunities, you get a little bit of it. And then the idea is like, well, I deserve it, or I am worthy of it, or I can manifest these things. I have a summer camp back home in Hawaii. And part of the reason I started it was like really three core things. I gave every kid a MacBook Pro. It's like the same computer I have. So you're limitless. If I can build anything, you can build anything. We gave them 10 days of kind of entrepreneurial coaching and mentoring. I had really great teachers when I was younger. And then the third one is somebody who just tells them like, you're exceptional. You're going to be successful. Again, I had this egotistical dad that is like, oh, you're a Monsef. Of course you're going to be successful. So I have a built-in expectation, rational or not, that I would be successful. And then that will manifest opportunities that become successful. So part of it was just to tell kids, like, you're incredibly bright. Like, the future's coming. This is going to be awesome for you. So I think, yeah, having some exit changes your brain a bit of like, oh, I can do this. And so then, yeah, you look for more opportunities and they present themselves because of that.
That is also a common thread that I've seen in founders. Like, even with Megan, you know, like, there's no doubt that like, oh, this crazy thing that I'm building is like not going to work out.
Yeah. And I'm not even starting a startup. It's just a community and a service-based business, but the startup will come, by the way. But I have this, yeah, I need to be humbled maybe a bit more. No, I think I've been humbled, but I'm just like, I'm going to show you. I've just, that chip on the shoulder is so big.
I think life humbles entrepreneurs enough, you know, like entrepreneurs don't need to do it themselves.
True. Yeah. The default mode is failure. So like, it's built in, but no, if you were humble and you had humility, you wouldn't do this. Like the default mode is failure, which is going to be pain. It takes a bit of irrational thinking to go, I'm the one. I think there was something, I can't remember exactly, but there was something around, spent a lot of my time now with pre-coaching founders. And some of the pushback is like, you have to go do this. I'm pretty aggressive about it. And my mom, who's still an entrepreneur, is like, you're pretty mean about the way that you say that. And I'm like, because with entrepreneurs, if I say, hey, there's 1,000 of them, you all have to go talk to customers first. You can't just like believe it. And like, look, maybe that happens 1 out of 1,000 times, but 999 of you, you have to go do that. All 1,000 go, I'm the one though. And so it's like, I have to push even harder on that one because, yeah, there are already people that believe in this irrational way to exist. And I think you wouldn't start a startup if you were a reasonable person.
There is also a difference between building like community and a service-based business where you only fail when you stop trying. Where it's a startup, if you've got this goal of 150 million or a billion, it's a goal that doesn't happen just because you don't stop.
I think as every flavor of a business has some of the same core ingredients. I think like tech startups get this unfair glamour and thing about it, but any business is incredibly hard to start. It's all the same ingredients. It's input, output. It's getting people to believe in you, communicating the story. Like they're all hard. They're all hard just in different ways. The one has just been glamorized because you get like crazy exits, but they're all hard.
Also, it's not about me. So we'll go back to you. Awesome. Okay, cool. So we're getting to you. We won't dive into it, but it's not a small feat or not a small thing. You worked at Zapier as head of growth for a bit. But I think we want to jump right into BraveCare from 2019, which is your second YC Combinator business. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's just for you for the editing. It's YC or Y Combinator?
Yeah, or Y Combinator.
What am I saying?
You said YC Combinator. It's the double Combinator.
We'll leave that in. Maybe I'm an idiot. I'm being humbled.
Yeah.
No, we leave that in.
No, I'll leave it in.
We knew we needed to move back to the West Coast, which we did. We're in Portland, Oregon. I had one taken a gig with Zapier doing head of growth work, sort of supporting them, realizing I'm a terrible employee. Wade, who runs Zapier, is like an incredible leader. Like, he's still an incredible model. Like, I love what he does and how he does it. And it was like, just, I'm just not the right person for this. So had gone back looking for opportunities. My kid split their chin at a bike park. I met a pediatric urgent care doc because he was stitching her face up. I was like, this is pretty amazing. Like, this is the scariest moment I've had as a person. This is like, to talk about parenting, it's like your heart exists outside your body, and this kid just smashed her face. And it's like, oh. And so there's nothing I can do to help that. So this is incredibly like powerful experience of having somebody take care of her. Like, why are there not more clinics like this? Like, what's going on? And so I met the doctor for coffee a couple times. The next weekend, my one-year-old had croup, which is basically like your esophagus swells and you can't breathe. And I know what that sounds like now. I didn't at the time because there's no training manual to be a parent, which is insane. And my wife was out of town both these weekends. So that's like an overnight I'm really worried about. Now, my youngest, go back to the same clinic. And it was like, yeah, I want to do more of this. And so had a clinic in place. And it was a good partnership. Like, look, I think I can build the tech here. The clinic business exists. We'll go back through YC. I think the mistakes we made was, it was a time where One Medical, a giant company, hadn't yet gone public. It was the beginning, Tia Healthcare. Like, it's, I hit the hype cycle right this time. First company, I'm building like a weird color website. It's very hard to fundraise for. It's not very, you know, sexy. Nobody cares. The second one was like, oh, that's when you hit the timing right. Because we raised $6 million before Demo Day. I didn't even do Demo Day. I just like played the hype. We raised the round. Go off to the races.
Do you not just do Demo Day any way to tick the box? Or you just like,
I didn't want to. It's not my favorite thing. I am an introvert in an extroverted role all the time. So I perform, I play this role, it exhausts me, and then I go recover. But like, it's the trade-off of what I do. Like, I don't want to stand in front of this group and do this if I don't have to. So I didn't do it. But you raise all this money, it's like the rocket is going now. And then COVID happened. So you're just rocket shipping to like insanity of whiplashing the business.
What I'm curious about is like, this doesn't fit the profile of a traditional venture-backed business. So what is it about the particular way that you were doing it, or, you know, this specific business model that made it appealing to investors?
Hype cycle is pretty motivating. I mean, investors are, they're all smart and wonderful and great value add. Often they're following trends, it's pattern recognition. And so the pattern at the time is like, something's coming for these legacy giant bureaucratic businesses. Technology can make them more efficient, you know, more connected, more efficient care, better margins, all this stuff. So that was just the like, that's this, like now it's obviously agents replacing people. That's the cycle that we're in. That one was like a health tech cycle. But we basically took a model. The current clinic that we had was not profitable yet. Like, we hadn't nailed the model, but it's like, well, we got to grow. Let's open more clinics. So they'll, you know, and then because we'd raised money and COVID was whiplashing and then money was frothy and easier to fundraise at the time, we ended up raising $40+ million for Brave Care over those 5 years, opened 5 clinics. We scaled a model that wasn't working yet. Like, and this is now even with Prees, like, just focus on making sure the small thing works before you scale it. Cause we just scaled problems. I then now have a business that's losing $1 million a month. We've got 100+ employees and it's like starting to look pretty dark. You know, the second return of depression as I'm fundraising for like a Series B plus, that's just not going to happen. And again, going back to, I'm performing every time I'm fundraising, I'm performing now as a person. But then like getting back to my own space and just like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm settling back. This is not that more heightened than I feel right now. That fundraise is like, I'm performing. And then I was just realizing how far I fell after that of like, oh shit, I'm not good. Like, the, when I'm not performing was in a dark spot, and it was like, that fundraise wasn't going to happen. It's a highly anxious, pretty depressing, pretty difficult thing to be a founder. And the more success you get, the more you're caring. And again, startups, just because we'd raised $40 million doesn't beget success. You know, now there's just more to lose. So I'm going to lose all that money for people and have to fire 100+ people who are all like awesome people. So that was a pretty like dark place to navigate through. And then I got through it and started another startup right afterwards.
There's a bit to unpack here, right? You started this business in a totally different space. It's a different industry. It's a different modality. Like, you were previously involved in tech businesses. Now this is like health, bricks and mortar clinic. Here's some employees.
Bricks and mortar?
Is that how you say bricks and
no,
mortar?
No, mortar. Leslie, this is a knowledge gap. Yeah. bricks and mortar is what you build. You don't put cars.
I have like 10 of these a day, by the way.
What I did was I started the business in a completely different space. And this goes back to the theme we've said a couple of times, which is irrational. Like, where would I think that I can operate a healthcare business? Well, it's like, well, I know how to solve problems. I see something. And again, I believe the world could and should be different. And I think I exist outside the rules of it. Most businesses have very similar bits. The hardest thing about healthcare in the US is that the insurance payer system makes everything convoluted. So I have multiple different insurance carriers. Every time I hire an employee, I have to go recontract all of them. It takes 6 to 9 months to get all the contracts in place. And then depending on which codes you use when they do the service, I make a different amount of money. So even at the end of that business, I would say, like, what's the average revenue we get per visit? This is like the simplest back of the napkin I need to do. It's like, well, it's a, I'm like, it can't be, well, it's a, like, I have built models that are millions of dollars difference if the number is 140 or 160. And so there was one moment where somebody's like, I think it's 138. I'd modeled like 199. That means we just lost millions of dollars instantly. That's like, again, a high spike of anxiety and stress. And it's like, well, we got to go figure this out and settle it. So yeah, it's the naive belief that I could build a healthcare business. And I, what I loved about Brave Care is we helped 50,000 kids that were sick and injured. As a parent, I went 32 times to Brave Care, not as the CEO. So like, I appreciated it. It was one of the ones that shut down and felt the worst because we knew parents would miss it. I just talked to my buddy, a previous co-founder who's a YC partner, talking about a product. And one of the questions he asked to know whether or not it was working was, it, well, if you shut it down, like, would people be really upset about it? And like, sometimes it's like, no, not really. They're like, they like it. Brave Care was like upset. These parents really were going to miss this thing. And so it was good. It was right. We made mistakes. Maybe I made mistakes. It was just sort of unrecoverable after the end of it.
So you've raised an incredible amount of money. You've got 100 staff. That's huge. You're like at the height of where people want to go. Are there things in hindsight before you decided, look, we're going to have to shut this down, that you think, and I think this is going to lead into why you've ended up building your current business, that were clear signals that maybe you were choosing to ignore?
Yeah, one of the hardest things as a founder is, like, if you're a pretty compelling founder, you can, as maybe you say, spin a good yarn. Like, you tell a good story, you're charismatic, you do it to yourself. Like, you're the number one consumer of your own bullshit. And again, you wouldn't do it if you were really pragmatic about it. And so you have to believe a bit of the story to even bother doing it. But then it's very confusing of like, what's the story and what's the reality and which part do you want to believe? If at any point you're highly rational, like, yeah, you don't do it. Like, it never made sense that it was going to work. Like, every startup doesn't make sense that will work. You just have to sort of like push your way through it. So in hindsight, there's like any number of things I go, oh, I think I could have done that differently. I feel like I made the best decisions with the information I had at the time. Like, I'm proud of the work that I did, but clearly I'm the leader of that company. I failed, but I don't know if I would have done it differently. Obviously, now I know the mistakes. It's very obvious in hindsight what I should have done.
One thing that I've noticed about really good founders is, yes, they're great storytellers and they do know how to spin a good yarn. And really good founders also kind of buy into a little bit of their own Kool-Aid, right? So they believe their own story. The problem tends to arise when they forget that it's a story and they're fully in this world where they can't decipher between like reality and signals and like what is the narrative that they've crafted.
Yeah, but there's some of it of really successful founders, especially in fundraising, are a bit of psychopaths. Like, they just believe it's crazy. Like, they're, you know, I'm going to make, this is inevitable. It's going to be a $1 billion thing. You're missing your opportunity. Like, that is how you get investment done. It's the, like, you know, Elizabeth Holmes gets all the flack for the Theranos failing. But like, man, if she pulled it off, she would have been the success story. Like, every founder who was successful has a similar part of their story where it's all a scam. It's all a house of cards. It's crazy. And they made it through. And maybe different levels of it. Like, maybe not everybody's committing fraud and things, but like in some level. Before I left Hawaii, and we talked about, like, I didn't appreciate Hawaii. And then I moved back. My kids are all born there. My wife and I are both born there. When I was sort of making this conscious post-exit leaving, I had a friend who's Hawaiian tattoo my arm, And I was coming back on a fundraising trip where the last meeting, this is the $6 million fundraise sprint. Like, it's so easy. Everything is great. The last meeting of the day before my flight back to Hawaii is like, but what, I mean, what if it was 10 instead of 11? It's like some question that didn't matter. But I was modeling it on the plane and it all just collapsed. Like the belief that I had that it would work. Like when I changed the number, you just saw it. It was like, oh my God, am I lying to myself? Am I lying to everyone? And it was such an acute level of stress all at once that I almost felt like I was going to pass out from the intensity. And then I didn't handle it well. I just called my buddy. I was like, let's do more tattoo. Like, let me just pain my way through this in a distraction instead of being reasonable and having therapy. But it's that, like, you got to just believe it. Otherwise, it won't work. Don't commit crimes and along the way. But yeah, like, you just have to go and believe it.
In just a moment, Darius will walk us through the rawest stretch of his career, raising $40 million, scaling a model that wasn't working, and having to shut it all down. We talk about this because this is Life After Launch. We're in your podcast feed and online, and you can listen to more by searching Life After Launch and hitting follow. This is the Aussie Founders Club podcast, and you can join our Slack channel with over 1,800 other founders and operators by Googling Aussie Founders Club and hitting join Slack. It is free.
Yeah, so I had shut down Brave Care, pretty painful, terrible, failure all around. You know, I have to do startups. It's the thing that fulfills me the most. And, you know, you solve your own problems. My kids are now increasingly more online. The internet's not really built for kids. Again, people like me just build shit and people use it. No one's really being thoughtful about what will this do to kids if we do it or not. So we started Genie with the idea that it would be a better internet for kids. And at the time, AI is making its big push. So great, let's build an agent for kids that is age appropriate, responds to them, is a good friend. There's a lot of nuance, though, when you actually sit down and go like, well, what is good for kids? Because I started with the assumption of like, yeah, always kind, always friendly. It's like, yeah, but that's not a good model. Like,
Jimmy, like the participation awards, right? Where you're so kind that you're not getting, building up these barriers.
It's not a life skill. Jimmy down the street, like you'd rather hang out with Jeannie because Jimmy's in a bad mood sometimes. It's like, yeah, but that's life. So if it's, well, then I'm like, well, now do I have to build my agent to be a bit of a jerk sometimes? And it's like, well, what's too much? We exist on the same device that Roblox or some other game would be on. I have to be as addictive as them as I don't win as a company. Like, I don't want to be that addictive. Like, I think I could build that product, but then Genie probably should have told the kid, like, well, you didn't come back yesterday. And now I'm really sad. Like, I don't want to do that to a kid. It was like, I don't actually want to win at this. And so there was this internal, again, you were believing in the future and then you get enough signal and go, hold on a second. Like, is this really aligning like all the things? And that was a moment where like, this isn't working. We actually went, there's another thing that's missing from the story is we then looked at the car space. I'm a car enthusiast. And then you build for yourself and solve problems. It ran into the same issue of like, well, that's a different issue. That is the most common startup trap, which is like, look, if people just change their behavior, this would really work. It's like, people don't though. So you talk to car enthusiasts, they say, man, I would love, I come every weekend to look at other people's builds and I don't know who they use for this part. I would love it if I could see that. It's like, cool, we built this thing. It's like super easy. AI helps identify, it's all there. And they're like, yeah, Instagram's fine.
I do believe that with the right technology, people do change their behavior though, because you get like an Instagram, right, where you're like, I hate this update. And then you like just become accustomed to it. But you need to, I don't know, there's like a whole bunch of perfect storm stuff that happened with that.
Yeah, people have to want to change. So you can't like, look, I just built you a better thing. You will want it. It's like, yeah. They have to be actively, I'm looking for the better thing. I'm doing these five other things and yours does this in one, so it's better. So through that was killing both Genie and then Rides was the exercise where I talk about, it's like, you know, in the movie where the soul has been sucked out of a body. We had to do this where we created this almost pre-persona for my founder and I, because I love car. I really wanted it to work. And it took this neutral third magic party to go, is it working? Yeah, they built like, well, who's using it? Your brother and your best friend are car enthusiasts. They're not using it. You're like, oh my God, they're not. And that was this like, well, what if people had that? What if they had... Really what YC is a 90 days, high pressure, focus on the most important things, set a clear and measurable goal, and then every week just focus on that. And then do it with somebody who's really honest and holds you accountable. So knowing the stage of your business, you're in the we haven't talked to customers, but we're going to build this thing. It's like, I'm working on my pitch deck. And Pri would, the agents, and there's like, is that what you're doing this week? Like, you haven't talked to customers yet. Investors invest in companies that have traction. Go talk to customers and build traction. And so we built Pri as this idea of that somebody who knows what you're doing, integrated to your data, and then has an agent that, you know, can be the mentor or advisor everyone would want.
Amazing. So you started Pri and we started it last year, right?
Yes, it's probably like 7 months.
But it's an idea that you've probably been thinking about for...
I talk to tons of founders. I'm an angel investor. And so there's like a lot of this, it's the same things. Like I often repeat the same stories. And for founders, it's the same thing of like, go talk to customers. You know, you have to interview them. You have to solve their real problems. You have to, you know, test the ugliest thing. If they won't pay for it when it's ugly, they're not going to pay for it when it's better. Ship earlier than you feel comfortable. There's like very common things. When I think about advice for founders, I don't like very specifically designed pieces of advice. You know, that this is a terrible analogy, but it's the only one I have. It's like if there's some war field and bombs are exploding and the resources you need are on the other side of the field, and somebody comes back and it's like, well, how did you survive? And they're like, well, what I did was, you know, I run 3 steps, then I dive, I run 3 steps. And then like, that worked for them. Like they're a different height, they're different speed. The bombs were like, it's so different. So I try not to tell founders, like, if you just do exactly these steps, you'll be successful. There are very common sort of the biblical rules of startups, talk to customers, do things that don't scale. These are all Paul Graham's pieces of advice. So those ones hold true. And so Pri is basically rooted in those standard pieces of wisdom. It has access to your data. I've written a bunch of my own philosophy into it. So it's trying to just extend that resource to every early stage founder to help where they're doing the 0 to 1. Like, is this a real thing? Should you continue to work on it or kill it? I often think I think the people Pri will help the most are actually the people whose ideas it will kill, not help succeed. Because so much is spent, wasted on things that aren't going to work. And it's like, sometimes being the critical voice doesn't feel good because you feel like a bit of a jerk. But I care more about future you than current you. And so I'm being a little mean to current you because you're hurting future you. Like, you're so in this thing, you're unwilling to hear that it's going to fail. And again, founders have to believe this irrationally. So you can't tell them that it's going to fail. You kind of have to walk them through it. And then they go, this isn't going to work. So Pri is made to do that.
Opportunity cost in startups is often like very undervalued. So what advice do you have to founders who are working on a business that is kind of working, they've drank their own Kool-Aid a little bit, and there's like some signals there, but it's not super clear, but then it's not really where it should be, and there could be other things that they could be doing?
You have to measure everything. This was going to be one of my life lessons, and I'm going to swap it, so I'll use it now anyway. But it's, if everything is an experiment and you do it like a scientific experiment, one, it just makes it more approachable. Like, the point is, you're not going to do this because you have to succeed. It's, you're going to learn from it. That's the whole point of an experiment. A successful experiment might mean that it failed, but you learned. And the only way that you can know whether or not it passed or fails is because you had a clearly defined number before you started it. So, hey, success to us, it's kind of working, but like, we'll know it. We had 10 more weeks, choose your arbitrary time amount. We need to get to, you know, 100 more users. And if we can't do that, then it's not working. But if you don't pre-agree to that point of measurement, it's very easy in this narrative. Well, it's because and something. And so you have to define what does real success look like better than kind of working is the hardest place to be in because it's very gray. And then there are some stories where like, you know, Color Lovers, it didn't work. It kind of worked for 9 years. And so what people hear is go, oh, he had to do that. Like, no, you know how many more opportunities I missed in those 9 years than what I was doing? So it's seen as a success I held on and therefore when I think it was, what did I miss on the other side of it? So measure it, set a goal, and then really hold yourself honest to whether or not you hit it.
So a lot of our audience will be the type of people who could benefit from jumping on Pri. You've told us sort of what it is as a concept, but what can they expect if they go and jump on the platform? And we'll also obviously put stuff in the show notes around it.
Yeah, you onboard by choosing, it's a 10-week sprint. So in 10 weeks, what number, if you change, would mean like, wow, this is much more successful than where we are. So you clearly define it. Then you chunk that into milestones because it's hard to think about things in too long of a time frame. You know, I need to ship this, then do this. both of those unlock the potential to get to the goal. And then every week is just what's the highest impact work that really moves the needle to moving those numbers up. The thing about founders, we're talking about busy schedules. We're busy all the time. Busy feels like progress. It's really not. And so you, at the end of a week, pre-audits and gives you feedback. So like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to talk to 15 founders this week. And it's like, well, you talked to 15 founders for 3 weeks. It has not moved the sales number. So is that the most important thing that you should be doing? Maybe it's this. And so it's this honest person where if you trust it and let it in, then it has access to your data. So it's not just like, well, you're so busy, you're doing so much. It's like, well, what's the result of that busyness? And is that working? So they integrate their tools, they onboard, and then it's this, you know, consistent feedback of, are we doing the highest impact work we can do?
Every episode, we ask our guests for three life lessons, three things they'd wish they'd known earlier in their journey. Darius learned his the hard way. Two startups, two exits, and a few dark stretches in between. Let's get into the first life lesson.
Founder life is very hard. And the trap is like, well, I'm super busy right now. I have to put the extra hour in. I don't have time to work out. I don't have time to eat right. It's the marathon. It's a sprint. It's just back-to-back sprints in a marathon distance. And there's always going to be a next thing. And so you compromise on the personal health, the eating poorly. You are, I hate saying this, like an elite athlete where you, in that you have to perform at your best, clearly not at the same athletic level. But the point is like your brain needs to function. You need to be physically comfortable. You have to have the energy to do this day in and day out. So I think focusing on your health is actually quite important, but it's a similar theme here and all this stuff. It's input output. So what is the most efficient thing that you can do to get those results? So it could be, or two things at once. If you went for a walk, one, it's physical activity, but you can do work thinking while you're walking, especially now with Claude. My warm-up time, my cardio time is all me talking to it, doing planning work for when I can get back. Cardio is a bit mindless and I think it's okay. But then when you have your weight training, it's like you're focused on doing it. Like the mind-body connection matters. So do it, do the highest impact work for the result that you want. And in fitness, it's, I'm trying to often grow muscle. So specifically do the thing that grows the muscle the most. Or if it's fat burning, do the thing that does that. When you try and do two things at once, you're just compromising and it doesn't work. Or somebody told me today, they wanted to go swimming for exercise because they wanted to have fun. I'm like, is that fun though? Or are you just doing two things poorly? Go exercise specifically in the way that does whatever you need, muscle mass, whatever, and then go do the thing that's most fun. Trying to combine those two just didn't make as much sense. But in all of that, health is incredibly important. Mental health is also a huge part of that. And I do think exercising, dopamine, like it impacts your mental health as well.
I have a two-pronged question. I feel like, and I want to get your thoughts on it, there are seasons where sometimes you just need to forego it because the outcome that you need to do in your business is actually just so, but maybe argue, fight me on this. Do you believe that there are sort of seasons where sometimes you might need to just give on that? And did you have something happen that was like, that led you to be like, I need to just prioritize this now?
I don't know if I would connect it. I've had skin cancer twice. They were basal cells. They weren't terminal, but there's like you get a doctor thing. It's like, well, you've got skin cancer. It's like, well, what does that mean? Like it forces a
you're nothing without your house
shit thing. And then like, what does it mean? Both of them were on my face and removed. So there's a point in time where like your face is cut up. It's a bit of reflections, my early 20s. And so there's something in there that probably like if I, again, I don't do therapy. I just plow forward. But yes, if I unpacked it somewhere in there is probably something that impacts it. But the season thing is it's not just health. There's all of them. Like I try and be a very supportive, loving, engaged husband and dad to three kids. There's always other uses of my time. Part of, I think, my highest role in my family is the securing our financial future. So I need to prioritize that. In order for me to do my best at that, I have to be in good shape. I have to have the energy. I have to perform. And so there's no answer to this. It's like you kind of need to know, but you need to know.
You're nothing without this vessel, though, to take you on that journey. Yeah. And if you're not looking after it, yeah.
But I mean, there is a reason why, you know, athleticism is very like a common analogy in business, because you do have to maintain a level of performance. And when you think about it at a systems level, it is all about maintaining a machine that turns the input into the right outputs. And fitness is a very big part of that machine.
Yeah, there's been kind of like an invoke. It's the longevity thing. It's the people now caring about like all your data, all your labs, the, you know, the nerd of who wants to start startups often then gets obsessive about the data. And I could take this supplement to
have
change this
level. Have you considered doing Everlab?
I haven't done Everlab, but I've been on TRT for like 8 years. So I've been on, you know, performance enhancing drugs for a while. The biggest thing was like a mental health. It was like life changing for me of some level of that, like anxiety and depression. Testosterone was like huge for me. In the last 3 years, I've been like a very like bodybuilding consistent effort. And that's a benefit in that. But I would say night and day, having my hormones in check was like just the mental performance was huge.
Mm. Amazing.
We don't talk nootropic protocols at some stage. It's like a very startup bro conversation.
Darius's Sick and Listen is the one founders find hardest to swallow. He shut down companies, walked away from a dream property in Hawaii, let go of projects that most people would have kept hammering at, and as you'll hear, it's a lesson he's still living out himself. So let's get into the Sick and Listen.
Be a quitter, like be willing to quit. And it's also related to the experiment thing. You do it, you fully believe it, you know, whole ass everything, don't half ass. But then if it's not working, again, likely because you set some clearly measurable goal, if it's not working, stop doing it. So the early part of my life in 20s, I think I looked very flaky. Like, you're doing that thing now? And then you started this thing and you're over here and I moved. And I think to my siblings, one of them who's like a bank manager and was like, did everything correctly in the right order. It's like, this looks, you're never going to be successful. You won't commit to anything. It's like, yeah, but I did it well enough and full enough to go, this isn't working. So I stopped doing that thing to do something else. And so I think there's some of like your identity gets caught up in things. I was the brave. I mean, my kids had like Brave Care shirts. I'm the Brave Care guy. I'm the parent, whatever. Like you adopt a persona. And it's like, well, now I have to do it because. And so like, is that the input for the best output for you in the scheme of your life? And if it doesn't, then like quit it.
I think I just come to an epiphany about something that I have said and put out into the world that I want to do. And because I've said it, I want to go do it. And I actually started feeling that I'm not connected to that thing anymore. I won't say it in case I do go do it because I have put it out into the world. But you might have just like landed with me there.
Oh, that's great.
I have learned a life lesson.
The hardest thing for something like that, because I have one of my good friends back in Portland, is the U role, this like community champion, always there for people, the hyper connector, all this. And then he's done things. And then when he stopped doing them, people are like, well, we need you to do it. It's like, are you helping them do it? Because it's just like free energy for someone. And so unless you're willing to like put the money in or help out, they get to let it go, you know, like they need to also take care of themselves when they're doing something. So it's very fair to prioritize yourself. There is an element of like when you're quitting, you also have to recognize if other people have committed to you and that there are responsibilities inside of it. So I have, you know, when Brave Care failed, like my co-founder is still mad at me about that. Like I mean, I sold him a dream. I wanted him to, you know, this is a medical provider, a very different, you know, not wired for entrepreneurship and tech. And when it failed, it was also like a doctor and somebody who'd really done this stuff. And then there's a failure is a failure. Like that's hard to process. But I think for him, that's a hard thing to get through when it like doesn't work out. And it's maybe fair. I don't resent him for it. It's like, yeah, I said it would work and it didn't. So it was a very hard journey. And sometimes for some people, like you can live in the failure, you can process it. And sometimes the healthy thing is like just to move on from it. Like if you can't process through it, like leave it for a later date to deal with and move forward. So I think there's a lot to just being willing to quit. You also, there's lots of opportunities. So we've, as a family, have moved around a lot. Like, oh, it's so crazy that you moved and you moved there. It's like, yeah, but if you don't like it, you just move back. Like it's not like because I've moved here, I'm not allowed to then move again or something. We're very happy here and I think we'll stay. But there's just a like, do it. And if it doesn't work, the hardest ones inside of that too are like quitting relationships, like friendships or even family relationships. There's an obligation because they're family or something, a history. There's like honoring what it was and who the person was, and then going again, future you is what I care about. Does that relationship benefit future you? And if it doesn't, like let it go. And it doesn't take anything away from the appreciation of what it was before. It's like they might be different and you're different moving forward. And just to let it
I also think, and I don't even have children that I need to accommodate in my life, but the businesses, your partner, your whatever. And as you get busier and your time gets more precious, sometimes some of these relationships that might have been like a bit frivolous, but they were fine, you kind of just need to cut them because you want to allocate it to the business or the things that are going to grow you more. And I definitely feel like I've experienced that recently.
I think it's like hard is because you also then don't owe the explanation to anyone. There's something, I don't know if it's just from where I grew up in Hawaii, some of the people I grew up with in friendships, like we don't see each other for 7 years, and then you're just right back in and then it just goes away again. And there's no guilt or something. Why didn't you stay in touch? It's like, cause we're both busy. Like we've got lives, but you can just fit back in when it works. And then it's okay to not.
Darius's third lesson asks you to hold two things in your head at once. Push harder than is reasonable, aim higher than is possible, then forgive yourself when you fall short. One of those is easy, the other's the work of a lifetime.
I find that there really is thematic things, like it comes up all the time. So some of these, like I didn't have to think about it. There's just like, I've said them a bunch of times, or I have versions of them, or this happens a lot when you're like pitching as a founder. Again, it's a performance. And I feel like I'm like workshopping material early on in a fundraise. I make a joke or I bring something up and I'm watching the reactions and I'm like trying to like build my set basically. But then I've done this like 100 times. The joke I'm making, I didn't, you know, it's like, oh my God, because this just happened. I'm like, no, it didn't. It happened like months ago and I've said it 100 times, but it's like a performance. So sometimes like when the script starts playing, I'm elsewhere. Like my brain is thinking about other stuff. It's just the pattern I've already like run so many times in the road. It's just the thing that's playing while I'm doing something else.
It's like the performative story you tell when you're pitching where you're like, this is why I did it. It was so, and it wasn't. It might have been that you saw an opportunity, but then you bit it and like this.
Yeah, it's the story. Like it's compelling.
So third life lesson.
I know, I just looked at it. you asked the question.
So much pressure.
Sorry.
I'm there.
It's interesting. They all like unify somewhere. It's to have very high expectations, but then give yourself grace for not meeting it yet. So I have exceptionally high expectations for my level of fitness. I'm 45. I got kids. Like there's no way I can achieve what my fitness goal is, but I don't want to also lower my standard. I just want to give myself the grace of like, yeah, it's okay. We're not there yet. But when I'm disappointed in not being where I am, instead of making myself feel like shit for it, to go, it's cool. Like we've made a lot of progress, but we've got a lot more to go. And I think for founders, it's the, like, they probably naturally have the high expectation, but haven't yet learned the grace skill yet. That's very depressing and hard. People are exceptionally hard on themselves. And that I think factors into depression and don't unwire, have this. You want to be the most successful entrepreneur. You want to do a thing that reach billions of people, but like give yourself some grace that you're not quite there yet, but you're on your way. Recognize the progress you've made. Again, still keep the full pedal to the metal, like just push as hard as you can, but like just give yourself some grace.
Well, sir, I think if you haven't, like with your fitness goals, right, if you're aiming here and you're going to fall short, 25%, you're better off than if you went for 50, right? Yeah.
Yes, another thing I always tell founders is like you should set unreachable goals and then fail getting there doing more than you would have if you just set an achievable goal. Because often you sort of like fill to the capacity of whatever you set for yourself. If you got 4 weeks to do something, you can do it in 4 weeks. If you say you can talk to 10 people, you're going to probably 8 to 10 of them. If you sometimes say, well, instead of your brain goes, hey, how many people could you call right now and do this thing? You're like, what's the, the easiest route in your brain goes, I could do 10. It's like, well, what if you did 30? Well, I couldn't possibly do what I just defaulted to. I'd have to completely rethink. It's like, well, then do that, like rethink it. And so, but then if you failed and got to 15 instead of the 30, well, you still did, five more than you would have if you had just said 10. So again, set very high, almost unachievable goals, recognize that that is still a huge amount of progress and that you just give yourself grace of that you're not there yet.
I think as I'm getting older, I'm learning more and more to take the little wins. So even if I don't achieve my, full goal, the fact that I've made progress at some point along that goal is something to be celebrated. And it just makes it easier to start the next thing,
Founders never celebrate enough.
Because there's a sense of relief instead of like being like, I've won this. You're like, oh, I needed to get there.
I follow Formula One. And so I've like half celebrated and that I wanted to buy champagne. And like, if you hit your goal, you know, it's podium, we're spraying champagne. I've not done it. Well, I went to the race. That was awesome.
Worth moving to Melbourne for.
One of the many reasons. But we bought champagne and then didn't celebrate the goal because there's always the next thing. You're not there yet. And so that'll always be true. If you can set a goal, measurable, and hit it, you should feel good, momentary celebration, and then move forward.
A huge thank you to Darius for sharing his story. Loved hearing about the wins, the dark spots, the companies he's walked away from, including the one he walked away from shortly after making this episode. Was it recording this episode that helped him make the decision? We'll never know. Or I could ask him. We'll have to find out.
Three lessons. Look after yourself. Be willing to quit. Give yourself grace for being human.
If you like this episode, send it to another founder who needs to hear it. If you're not already in the Aussie Founders Club Slack, come and join thousands of founders and operators working through the same chaos that you are. The link is in the show notes. Thank you for joining us for Life After Launch. We'll see you next week.